Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be speaking with Courtney Martin. She's the author of the new book, Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists. I'm very happy now to welcome the good folks from Theater Grotesco. John Flax is the artistic director. Kate Kita is the managing director. They're both actors in the company. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you.
Glad to be here.
So you guys are doing a bunch of pieces called OM, or O-M, stands for Outlet Mall, but also OM for Meditate. Well, it's called OM, 10 Tiny Epics in an Outlet Mall, which opens this coming week. They go through from August, is for a whole month actually, that you're going to be running these pieces, August 27th through September 26th at this Outlet Mall. What are these pieces about? 10 tiny epics. Tiny epic is the found oxymoron of the day.
They are about many different things. That's what they are. They're 10 tiny epics. Each one has a different theme or a different place where it was inspired from. And yeah.
We do this every 3 or 5 years or so, and we ask each company member to create a piece. And we put no stipulations on it. No wedding cakes in there. No, it has to be set in this period. It's just whatever that particular artist is impassioned by at that moment. And then we find a vehicle to place them all in. And in this case, it's a set of 30 antique doors, and it's at the Outlet Mall.
That's great. Now, this is in your rehearsal space, which is turning into a performance space.
It only because some of our shows are so intimate that they can fit in a very small space like this. Actually, this is probably the first show that we've realized could fit into such a small space. And it's as an audience member, when I'm an audience member, if I can see an intimate piece, that's like the height. Nothing's better than that. It's like sitting in the first row at the opera.
Right, exactly. Yeah, because you're so close. And I mean, I love that. You see people sweating and hear them breathing
exactly.
And all of that. And, of course, so they're all original pieces, and they're by the various members of Theater Grotesco, and they all, I haven't seen them all. I went to a rehearsal the other day, but they have that typical Theater Grotesco combination of visual and physical comedy and very quick dialogue.
That's true.
That's nice, yeah. I'll go with that. Except for the silent ones. They don't have any dialogue.
Right. So one of the things that I saw was a piece about, it was called Housekeeping, and it's basically about two people who clean the rooms in hotels. And so you see their, what would you call them, travesuras, their things that, their naughtiness and their work and all the funny things that can happen in that context.
And it's fun to take a banal work situation and just find the humanity of people in those places, yeah.
So what, if anything, is inspiring about the Outlet Mall for the pieces that you're doing?
Let's see. Now, you've opened a good can of worms here.
It's a weird place.
Well, it's interesting because I think most Santa Feans, if they go down there, it's rare and they go for something specific. So it's on the very edge of town. I think that it's one of those things that happens all across America. If you're driving on the freeway and you see an outlet mall, you might say, oh, let's go see Liz Claiborne and some of those shops. And that's who's there. Yet, there's trees growing in there and gardens and this beautiful courtyard that runs up and down. And we've been rehearsing there for 3 years, so it's like our home. And that's how the OM happened. We call it the OM just because it was Outlet Mall, so we'd say, yeah, rehearsal at the OM at 2. And when we decided to perform down there, we kind of embraced that community, and we're part of that, and we're inviting our audience to come into those courtyards surrounded by those stores and see theater in a new location.
Do you get the people who work in the stores to come and see the performances?
We're certainly hoping to, yeah.
This is the first time we've done it, but we've made a lot of friends there. So the people in the kitchen store next door, they always smile when they see us, and they say, we're so glad you're there. When is the show open? And I want to see it. Can I bring my girlfriend? And
We actually rehearsed Twelfth Night 2 years ago. We had to do it outside in the courtyard. And we made a lot of friends during that rehearsal process because we were throwing brooms and running around. And well, because the ceiling in the outlet mall is only 10 feet tall, which is a bit of a limitation for the kind of work that we generally do. And so for that production, we took it outside to rehearse that. This year, for Ohm, 10 Tiny Epics in an Outlet Mall, we're actually embracing that a bit more, and we're working with it.
The height limitation.
Yes.
How do you work with the height limitation?
Well, we're playing with it. You know, we've actually built a mezzanine, and we are, there's a second story in this production, and we just grace underneath the ceiling, but it's a mezzanine gymnasium. You'll just have to see.
Yeah, I mean, it's a kind of surrealistic space with the theater lights sticking out of the holes in the acoustic tile.
Uh-huh. And there's risers for the audience so they get good views. And,
right.
Yeah. Multi-levels.
So Theater Grotesco has been around for a really long time.
Yeah, we're older than, let's not go there, but 27 years we've been around. That's a long time.
So how does this set of pieces fit into the evolution? Sort of where are you at in your artistic evolution as a company?
This is the fifth time that we've done a collection of short works. So, you know, if we were writing literature, this is the period when we write short stories.
Right.
And so there's something very organic about that. Actors, even though they're going from play to play, and those are full-length plays, a lot of them, especially if they're creators, are working on little characters or a little story or a little tiny piece that just kind of comes and they create that. And this is when we collect all those together and show it to the public. So it's our fifth collection of short stories.
Now, are these in any way work in progress? Do you expect some of these to evolve into other kinds of longer pieces?
Yes, I'd say so. Several of them are just the first exploration into an idea, you know, that a company member has, and hopefully we'll use this as a laboratory. We'll get a sense of how it's received by audiences and how it grows over the course of 5 weeks in performance, and then hopefully we can touch on it again. It's truly, this process is such a gift to actors especially, because we really get to indulge and try something that we've been thinking about for a long time. But it's also great for audiences, I think, because they can just get a taste of all the different things that we can do. You know, we work with masks in this piece, we do dance, we have some pieces that are based mostly on strong images that actors are working with.
Having pieces that are based on images is something that when I first started many years ago before I moved to Santa Fe, I worked for a company that did experimental theater and performance art, and I had no idea that there was a whole genre of performance that started with an image rather than a plot idea and moved forward from there.
There's a lot of different ways to tell a story. And you know, a lot of times we think we want to know what that beginning, middle, end is, who the characters are, what the interaction's going to be. And that's one way of telling a story. But really what we want to do is give something to the audience, move them in some way. And, you know, if you look at the broad spectrum of performance, music does that, dance does that, all without storylines necessarily, though they would probably argue with me because they do have dramatic arcs that they follow. So, you know, this is a chance for audiences to open up a little bit and allow yourself to be moved by something other than a strict storyline.
And you, Kate, are doing dance as well.
I am.
Pure dance.
It's, you know, we're calling it, what are we calling it? A movement piece. The choreography is by Elizabeth Wiseman, and she began with wanting to explore earth and sand and water, the elements in choreography. And so we started with that, and she started with some gestures and some movements. And she tried them out, or I tried them out on my body, and we had a really beautiful dialogue that went on for about 2 months. We developed this piece, and it's turned into this, I guess you could call it a dance in the end. Yeah.
Now, when you perform these pieces, are there some performances where you're asking for audience response? Are there some talkbacks?
Do you mean like after the show?
After the show.
Yeah, we do that every Friday night and every Sunday night. And Friday nights, we're doing what you were involved with last year, where we have a guest commentator and a guest moderator come in. Yeah. So
that was
so
fun.
It was really fun, and the dialogue then opens up even more because it's not strictly between the audience and the company, but there's a third party and fourth, so it gets pretty exciting.
Do you, when that happens, get feedback that you are really able to use?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for sure. Even with a show like Dead Man, Rich's Dead Man Alive that we performed last year, there's a lot of different takes, and people like to tell you what they learned or what they experienced in the performance, and I definitely think that we can take that in and use it.
Yeah, you know, it's not necessarily the goal to let's take what we learn and change the piece. It's more to have a dialogue, and it's always fascinating to us to hear how the work is received, what people are getting from it. Because sometimes it's exactly what we had in mind. Sometimes it has nothing to do with what we had in mind, but it's great that they're getting that. So it's just a really interesting dialogue.
And it's also, I think, really interesting for audience members to participate in that kind of dialogue, because you realize that although there is an end point, I mean, we had Sherman Alexie on the air once, and he was at the Lenzing not too long ago and gave a wonderful speech, but he was on the air one time, and I asked him, how do you know when your work is finished? And he said, the publisher's deadline. And I thought, it's probably the same for a lot of theater, you know, especially original work like what you do. Oh, performance time is coming. It's going to be done.
Yeah, different than a piece of literature, we run the show for 5 weeks, so it evolves whether we're aware of it or not. We also, though, can make changes, and sometimes, often, we bring shows back, and then we go back and, you know, tear it apart and redo it and add things, take things out, all of that. So it's always alive.
There was an opera review during the opening of the opera season, and there was a little piece of criticism of one of the operas that said, and this may be worked out during the course of the season. Do you take feedback from, like, newspaper criticism? Does that help you evolve or improve the shows when you have such a long run like this?
I think it depends on the show, but I would say generally yes. I'm one of those people that reads everything. A lot of actors don't like to see how they're reviewed, and that's perfectly normal. But I like to take it. And I don't know if it necessarily, like John said before, I don't know if it really changes it, but it might wake something up in me that I didn't realize was going on. I might pay more attention to that. I don't know. It's a lot of nuance, I'd say.
And we get a lot of feedback from other company members and other artists and audience members, and that can subtly change work during the course of the run as well.
And the other thing that I was thinking of, the effect on the audience members, is you not only do you see that this is a work in progress, but you also see that your whole life, you, the audience member, is also a work in progress. And you can kind of think about what feedback is like for you and how you change things and stuff like that. So it's very much a template for life itself.
That's cool. I didn't
know.
That's
nice.
Like
yeah.
That. I like that.
We're talking to Kate Kita and John Flax from Theater Grotesco. So you're starting this Thursday night, and you're doing 5 weeks. That's a really long run. Why so long?
It's actually, just before we go past, it's Friday night.
Oh, sorry, Friday.
Yeah, August 27th we open, and then 5 weeks?
5 weeks. It's a very small space. I mean, I think at last count we can get about 88 people in there. So we're used to having about 2,000 come to see any given show. So we can sell out.
So you did the math.
We did the math, yeah. Even theater artists, you know. But also we prefer to do a long run because the work's all new. And it really is, it evolves over time, and that gives us a lot of satisfaction.
So we talked about the housekeeping piece and your dance piece. Tell us, give us a kind of sense of some of the other quote-unquote tiny epics.
Well, there's an epic where about an astronaut who's kind of cut loose that mirrors a whale who's the last survivor of his species.
Oh, Lord.
Uh-huh. A little thing about loneliness. There's four scenes that happen in a gym, and there's a mysterious guest that arrives in the gym. And we can't tell the audience who it is. Fair enough.
Fair enough.
There's a piece that I'm doing that's an improvisation every night. It's a structured improvisation, but it will be different every night. So I'm going to be hanging out there in the wind for the people to take pleasure with. And it's called A Storm. It's about the biggest storm in the world. What more?
There's a ritual piece.
Mm-hmm.
A plunge into the world of rituals.
There's a beautiful monologue that Rod does about a can that someone finds in their pantry that doesn't have a label on it anymore.
Oh, great.
Beautiful piece.
Yeah, that's a good taste of it, I think.
So this is all happening at Theater Grotesco at the Outlet Mall, which I drove past the other day when I was trying to find it, and I was on my way to the penitentiary before I turned around and made a U-turn. So it's sort of, when you're going down Cerrillos Road, the Outlet Mall is right kind of adjacent to the exit to go to Albuquerque. So right around that time. On your left, you will see this little adobe set of buildings perched on a kind of little hilltop, and you turn in there and you can find it pretty easily. I'm sure it'll be well marked for the performances.
Sure will.
Yeah.
So this is August 27th, that's this coming Friday, through the 26th of September at the Fauchon Outlets of Santa Fe, Cerrillos Road at I-25. And after this weekend, it'll be Thursdays through Sundays at 7 in the evening, no matinees.
That's right.
7 every night. The opening night gala is this Friday, the 27th of August. And then the Pay What You Wish performances are this coming Sunday and then thereafter, every Thursday night, so people can come regardless of budget. You can go to theatergrotesco.org, and Grotesco is spelled G-R-O-T-T-E-S-C-O. John Flax is the artistic director. Kate Kita is the managing director. Many other wonderful members of this company, and we are so happy that you're here, and we look forward to seeing you.
Thank you.
Thanks.
So much.
Come on down.
Yeah.
I'm very happy now to welcome Courtney Martin. She is the author of the new book, Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists. And she will be at Garcia Street Books tonight, Tuesday at 5 in the afternoon. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thanks so much for having me.
So this is a book about activism in the generation of people who are now basically in their 20s and 30s,
right.
People around your age. How did you decide to follow the lives of the 8 people you profile in this book?
Well, I think like a lot of authors, I end up writing the book I need to read. And so this was really grew out of a case of me feeling really disillusioned, particularly following the 2004 presidential election. I'd been out of school for a little while, and I had all of these big dreams about what I wanted to do in terms of sort of making the world a better place. And I came to find out that it was much more complex and difficult than I had thought it would be. And so I ended up feeling really disillusioned and really like sort of at this existential crisis moment of how do you actually make the world better? It seems so daunting. It seems so bureaucratic. It seems, you know, these huge corporate conglomerations make it so difficult to really make a difference. So I decided to kind of look to my own peers for some of the answers and thought that a really good way to sort of search for kind of the great new ways of making social change would be to look at people my own age who are doing it every day. And so I found these 8 sort of extraordinary, ordinary people, as I like to talk about them, and just sort of followed them around and looked at the ways that they make choices.
And it's interesting because the reasons that they got into activism are very different. They range from rape and sexual abuse on the one hand to an excess of privilege on the other. So I thought maybe we could just talk about some of them. Tell us about Maricela Guzman.
Yes, Maricela Guzman is a veteran. She grew up in East LA of immigrant parents, and she was really struggling to get through high school and to support her family. You know, she's the kind of kid who negotiated her parents' terrible subprime mortgage at the age of, you know, 14. So she had a lot of responsibility on her shoulders. And she met a recruiter who basically convinced her, you know, the military is the way to go. You're going to get college paid for. It's going to help take care of your family, et cetera. So she joined the military, and she was actually raped in boot camp. And had a lot of years of silence about that, but eventually ended up meeting a lot of other women veterans who had similar experiences, and they sort of helped support her to come out about what she'd experienced. And eventually she created an organization called the Service Women's Action Network, SWAN for short, that is now advocating on behalf of women in the military in general, but obviously very focused on the military sexual assault issues.
It's a story that's so moving and scary, and you follow her, and there's some details of her story that we don't know because she's still, as you write, kind of working it out in therapy and things like that. But she was raped by a superior officer in boot camp and basically didn't even report it. And
yeah.
I guess that's the culture of for women in the military.
Yeah, and I think one of the scenes that it sounds like you were as affected by as I was, and I hope to do it justice in writing, was that she did go to try to report it to a supervising officer. And because it was this very emotional moment, she just sort of burst right into the door of his office. And he said, get outside. You know the protocol. You knock. You say, you know, may I enter? Come back in and do 20 push-ups. And so she ended up, you know, over and over and over again trying to tell this man in this moment what was happening to her. And he kept throwing this protocol at her.
Right.
And finally, she just lost her nerve. And I thought that that was just such a powerful moment that represents such a macrocosmic problem, which is the military and the way in which it doesn't listen to its officers, the way in which the culture of the military is just so sort of, you know, masculinized and toxic in a lot of ways, that people's individual voices and humanity get sort of squashed by that system.
Right, and I couldn't help thinking, I mean, she describes this moment in which she's raped, but she is not able to see the person's face.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was probably that dude whom she tried to report it
right,
to.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, that could certainly be a possibility.
Yeah. So she basically went out in the world and is doing this work with SWAN. And, you know, with each of these activists, and maybe we can talk about most or all of them, one wonders what is their perception, and what do you think is Maricela's perception of the good that she's doing through her experience and through bringing help to other people?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, the interesting thing about the folks I've chosen, with the exception of two of them, is that they are very under the radar. None of these people is used to talking to the media. None of them is sort of seen as, you know, the sort of a star in their field. They're just really ordinary activists. So I think Maricela, like a lot of the others, is incredibly humble about the good she's doing. I mean, she can tell me, you know, I helped educate this young immigrant teenager about what the military is really like and prevent him from enlisting, or, you know, I held the hand of this woman as she shared her military sexual assault experience for the first time. And, of course, you and I can sit here and go, that is good. You know, that is really doing good in the world. Maricela is very humble, so she's not going to, you know, wave any flags above her head about that she's someone who should have recognition. And that's really one of the things I found so touching about a lot of the folks I found, is that they aren't people who get recognition. You know, our media very rarely covers positive stories, particularly about people my age, doing good in the world, and there's just such a variety and quantity of them out there, and so it was really fun to be able to interact with people who don't necessarily have a big ego about the work they're doing.
The first person whom you profile is Rachel Corey, and
mm-hmm.
she's the only person in the book who's not living now.
Right.
And I knew a little bit about her, but I was astounded at how much she wrote by the time
amazing,
she died at the age of 23.
Yeah, really amazing. Norton, a publishing company in New York, had put out a book of her writings that her parents and sister sort of culled from her diaries, etc. And, you know, that's... I was really moved to focus on her own words, so I'm excited to hear that you liked that, because there's been so much controversy over Rachel Corey's story. She, for folks who are listening and aren't familiar, was a young woman from Walla Walla, Washington, of all places, who decided to go to Palestine and get involved in protecting Palestinian families' homes from this sort of bulldozing that was going on at the time, and she ended up being killed by a bulldozer that ran her over when she was standing between a bulldozer and a Palestinian family's home. And she was really sort of caught up in this, you know, posthumously, this controversy. The Palestinians sort of took her on as a martyr. Israelis felt like she had been duped and she was part of, you know, this sort of mind-washing situation. her own parents have started a foundation, are really trying to talk about her as just a peace-loving young woman with a lot of heart and courage. So I really wanted to sort of extract her from all of this controversy and say, what in her own words was she doing? Like, what brings this young woman from Washington all the way to Palestine to stand in front of that bulldozer? What is it in our hearts and in our heads that we might have in common with her? And so I was so relieved that there was all of that writing, and really magnificent writing. I mean, I was really impressed with her capacity to describe what she was going through.
It's striking in her story that she has parents who really were very liberal and very open in the way that they raised her and the other children in the family, and that sense of looking at a wider world than just the family and the small community, and looking not only at a person's own success, but really making a difference. And this showed up very early in her life.
Absolutely. And it was an interesting dynamic, because one of the reasons I wrote the book is I felt like I similarly have very progressive parents who've always taught me to, you know, take issues in the world personally and be kind and curious and, you know, really be an activist. But one of the things I think that happened for a lot of us of this generation was we were sort of pumped up with all of this kind of save the world messaging, and also we are the kids of self-esteem education, so we were all told we were like these perfect, beautiful snowflakes, which of course is very nice in one regard. And in another regard, you know, I think has led a lot of us to feel a little bit disillusioned when we get out in the real world and we realize, wow, you know, I'm going to be making copies for a lot of years, or you can do everything in your power to get someone elected and it still might not work, and you have to keep going. You don't get to sort of collapse and say, well, why didn't I get the reward at the end of all of this hard work? And so I think there's a real sense among my generation of kind of grappling with some of that save the world socialization that we got, and kind of figuring out, okay, what does this look like in a real world way? And Rachel Corrie, interestingly, I think really fell into that, because she had these parents who really pushed her to take things personally, and that her sensitive nature was really valuable, but didn't give her, it seems like, a lot of clear sort of paths for how do you actualize this. And so she ended up in Palestine, of all places.
And she ended up almost having a premonition of her own death. I mean,
yeah.
There's a piece of writing where she says, I imagine dying on a crumbling piece of earth falling down. And that's what happened.
It's so weird. Really
amazing.
Amazing writing, and just such a gripping story. There's actually a play that was also constructed out of her words. And
yeah.
So she's, I mean, her legacy has really lived on.
So Rachel Corrie is another person in this book. We're talking with Courtney Martin about her new book, Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists. Another striking story is that of Raul Diaz.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Raul is like an incredible human being. He grew up also in East LA, actually very near Marisela Guzman. But he grew up at sort of the height of some of the worst gang violence in a neighborhood called Boyle Heights. And it was also a time when a lot of politicians were sort of, and court system was really trying to crack down on this violence and talking about the super predators. You know, they're calling 15-year-old boys super predators. And so it was just a really explosive time of both violence and real criminal crackdown, giving, you know, very young kids long sentences in juvenile detention centers. And Raul sort of came of age in this, and he ended up getting taken in by a man named Father Greg Boyle, who's a real incredible hero in that area, who was trying to create alternatives for young people outside of sort of this huge violent culture that was luring a lot of them in. And so Raul really learned his activism from this, you know, Catholic priest named Father Greg Boyle, and he ended up working with youth on violence prevention stuff, and ultimately now works at a place called Homeboy Industries, which is just an incredible organization that Father Greg Boyle started. And it's really multifaceted. Basically, it's trying to replicate a community, which is what folks who get into gangs are often looking for, but in a healthy sense. So there's job training, there's tattoo removal. You know, now they're doing solar panel installation training so that the guys can sort of get interested in environmental justice stuff. Like, they have therapy, they do meditation. I mean, it's everything you can imagine. It's sort of this one-stop shop of incredible community. And Raul, his specific role there now is as a prison reentry social worker. So he takes mostly guys who have been in prison potentially from the time they were like 13 to 17, and now they're entering the world, real world, and he really tries to shepherd them through that process. And, you know, as you can imagine, it's a really daunting one if you've never been out in the real world as an adult, and here you are sort of thrust into it. There are just all kinds of issues that he really helps the guys navigate.
And one of them, and as you were talking about these strong sentencing rules and kids being put in prison when they're 13 or 12 or 15 years old, one of the big issues that these young people have to deal with when they finally get out of prison is they've never been with a woman before.
Right? Wasn't that fascinating? Yeah. I was really struck by Raoul's honesty about that one of the biggest issues for these guys is they've, you know, never had any sexual experiences, and they're supposed to be these tough machismo, you know, guys, and they don't really know how to deal with that. So there's a, you know, you can imagine that a lot of violence can stem from feeling that insecure or feeling this sense of powerlessness out in the real world again. And I think Raoul really intervenes with them at such an important moment and kind of talks to them like an older brother or, you know, a trusted uncle kind of figure about some of that stuff.
I think it's important reading this to see how crucial it is that a person doing that kind of job is somebody who the inmates who are about to get out can relate to, either because of the person's personality or background or having suffered in ways that are like what they have suffered, the people who are on the inside. And Raoul becomes, for many of them, not so much a professional as really a family member and somebody who's willing to go the distance with them.
Absolutely. And that's really the level of both intimacy and commitment that it takes to do that job well is what you sort of understand after hanging out with him. And it's also an interesting contrast because Father Greg Boyle, who is a very celebrated figure and started Homeboy Industries and all this stuff, is clearly Raoul's mentor. And yet Raoul actually has an asset that Father Greg Boyle will never have. He's, you know, this white Catholic older man who, as long as he's been in that neighborhood, you know, can never truly reach the level of intimacy that Raoul, who was born and raised there and comes from the same ethnic background, can really have with those boys. And so it's...
And he can't tell them how to be with women. Or,
right.
Or if he can, he's not going to.
Right. That's a very good point. That's a an obvious area in which he probably would not be as helpful. But yeah, it's just sort of an interesting contrast because it highlights the ways in which doing community-based work, you know, all of us looking at our own communities and looking at how we can contribute is so important. It's not all about kind of, unfortunately, I think a lot of folks from my generation have a study abroad mentality when it comes to some of this work. Like, we have to go abroad and help. I mean, Rachel Corrie is an example of that, right? Instead of helping anyone in Walla Walla, Washington, she went to Palestine. So there are beautiful things about that, and I think there's also some real detriments to our generation always feeling like we have to go somewhere else to help people out instead of recognizing, you know, in our own backyard there's a lot of probably work that needs to be done.
I suppose on some level that is a reflection of what kind of coverage all these things get in the media. There's probably more coverage of bulldozings in Palestine than there is of, you know, homelessness in Santa Fe.
Right. There's a real romance about a lot of kind of the foreign causes that we can attach ourselves to. And I think the other huge issue is people's own sense of responsibility. You know, I live in Brooklyn, New York, and, you know, if I go to New Orleans and try to help out, I may feel a certain responsibility as an American, but I know, you know, I don't have much to do with that particular, the lower Ninth Ward, right? I live in Brooklyn. But if I'm in Brooklyn and I go volunteer in Crown Heights, the neighborhood I am currently gentrifying to a certain degree, I mean, there's some real ethical issues for me to wrestle with. It's not quite as clean as some of the kind of foreign activism that we can all get involved in when you're really working in your own backyard.
Right, right. We're talking to Courtney Martin about her new book, Do It Anyway. By the way, she's going to be at Garcia Street Books this afternoon at 5 o'clock. So let's see. Now here's one who's different from all the others, Tyrone Boucher. He is a man whose father made a lot of money, gave him a trust fund that he could use and do whatever he wanted with, and he decided to give it away.
Right. Yeah, Tyrone's an incredible thinker and incredibly generous figure, actually, although he would hate me to say that, because his perspective is that the inheritance he received wasn't really deserved. He thinks that it's unethical for anyone to be rich, essentially. And so he doesn't see what he did as some sort of, you know, hugely generous act, but really as a logical outcome of his own values, which are such that he doesn't think anyone should be able to have, you know, 14 times the amount of money that anyone else has.
And so what did he decide to actually do with his money? I mean, it's not easy. You can say, okay, I've got $400,000.
Right.
I'm just going to give it to, well, let's see, what do I do now?
Yeah, huge question. What really happened to help empower him was he fell into this organization called Resource Generation, which is a really interesting organization created by and for wealthy kids. And basically their idea is, you know, we always think about organizing poor people, but actually we need to organize rich people so that they can talk about their issues and actually figure out how to live ethical lives. So Resource Generation has been sort of become kind of a coming out opportunity for rich kids who spend a lot of their lives sort of vacillating between, you know, hanging out with similarly wealthy peers or trying to pretend they're not wealthy when they're with us old regular folks. And so it's a really interesting organization.
Which doesn't work very well.
Right, of course. The Trustafarians, as a lot of people talk about them. But, you know, so Tyrone sort of fell into this organization and realized, okay, there's a whole context here. There's a whole group of young people like me who are inheriting a lot of money and uncomfortable about it. And so from there, he sort of learned more and more about philanthropy. And now he considers himself what he calls and a lot of other young people call a social justice philanthropist. And how that differs from regular philanthropy is that they're really trying to break away from the kind of foundation, nonprofit giving models where it's very top-down. It's kind of the rich people decide who deserves our money and get to spend a lot of time making the people that get the money prove to them that they did something good with the money, right? So Tyrone and others like him feel like that's just as patronizing as any other class system in which rich people get to decide what's good and what's not. So social justice philanthropy is more oriented around community giving. There's a lot less kind of grant applications, a lot less sort of checks and balances. The trust and sort of the sense of where the money should go is really put more into communities. So one of the projects that he got really involved in was in New Orleans, which I referenced earlier. And what he did was basically got a bunch of his own money and then got a bunch of other rich kids and, you know, rich relatives and friends to give money. And then they gave all of that money to a local New Orleans foundation that really knew the lay of the land, knew who was doing the work on the ground, and was able to distribute it. And that created a sort of process by which those people in New Orleans who are on the ground, who don't have time to write a grant, who don't have time to market themselves, who don't have time to network with wealthy people, could actually receive that money.
So it does bring up a lot of questions about the role of philanthropy in the first place, whether it's social justice philanthropy or any other kind of philanthropy, versus sort of systemic political change,
yeah,
which is, I think, much, much bigger in terms of, you know, one policy change regarding the taxation of inheritance dwarfs anything that all of these people could do, and most of them aren't doing it in the first place.
Right. That's such a huge issue and really wise of you to point out, because I think a lot of people focus just on who are the philanthropists and where are they giving money, but there are so many systemic issues that influence all of that. And also, you know, there's actually a really great book called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded, which taught me a lot about what I know about philanthropy, being pretty new to it. And basically it talks about the history of philanthropy, the way in which it was basically created to protect, you know, rich, wealthy, you know, sort of empires. And now it's developed into this thing where we're all trying to do good, but we rarely sort of look at the origins of it and how it's evolved and sort of these issues of bigger level systemic change and bigger level inequalities. You know, we can give money to rebuild the Lower Ninth Ward, and that's certainly worthwhile, but what are we doing to actually change, you know, the entire system so that kids who grow up there get well-educated and have a chance to actually go out and get a job that will give them a chance at a life in the same way I had the chance at a life.
Right, which I think in this country is portrayed as a kind of impossible rocket science, whereas, I mean, not even, it's impossible. Rocket science is possible. It is, whereas in Europe, you know, everybody gets educated.
Right.
In most countries.
Right. But of course, when we talk about that here, that immediately gets labeled as socialism and people freak out. And so there's just so much resistance to reducing inequality in any kind of systemic way that I think we have a hard time in this very polarized political moment actually going there.
So one of the things that struck me while reading through your book was that a lot of the activism that people are doing now have deep roots in the 1950s and 60s civil rights movement, environmental movements, and it seems like, you know, you and the various people that you profile are kind of walking in that shadow. What is the continuity and what's different now?
great question. One of the things I intentionally did not do was profile someone who did a lot of online activism. And I'm actually someone who's very involved in the blogosphere and really believes in the power of online activism. But I felt like the story about my generation that often gets told is, oh, people used to take to the streets, now young people only type away on their computers. And I just think it's a really false dichotomy. And that's part of why, speaking of the shadow, I didn't necessarily profile people who are strictly doing online activism, because I want to show that there are a lot of people, you know, taking to the streets in various ways. I think,
well, and they're not taking to the streets with signs. They're
right.
taking to the streets by the work they do.
Exactly. And I think it's really community organizing. I mean, there's such an incredible tradition in this country and so many others of community organizing, you know, Saul Alinsky and all these incredible figures. And so a lot of the folks that I'm looking at are really trying to find what I call this intersection of their greatest gifts and the world's deepest needs, and kind of looking at where is that sweet spot. I think a lot of the activism, and Tyrone in particular is really interested in a lot of the 70s, late 60s activism, a lot of that activism sort of like burst with this huge explosion of excitement and then really burned out. I mean, I think that my generation is aiming to sort of create activism as occupation. So it's not something that, you know, when you turn 30 and you have your kids and you settle down and you realize, man, it's hard enough to pay my own mortgage. I can't really spend all this time thinking about everybody else. You know, the idea is really to create a sustainable activism that is organic to our lives, that helps feed us, that has its own self-interest. I think we're really not, as a generation, opposed to saying my activism is self-interested. You know, I want things to be better for both myself and others, and I get, you know, a lot out of doing the work that I do, and having that, figuring out how do we sustain that for the long haul instead of sort of this explosion of activity that dies out.
There's a kind of cute story that you tell about being a little girl and getting really galvanized by the horrors that you are just beginning to see around you, and you go around collecting money for the poor. Tell us about that.
Yeah, I grew up in Colorado Springs, Colorado, so I had, you know, a little bit of exposure to poverty, just sort of on the street, see a homeless person, whatever, and I was very sensitive from the time I was very young, and as I said, grew up in a family where we were taught to take things personally, and I decided, well, people on my block have money, so why don't I just go right around the entire block and knock on doors and ask for money? So I did that, and I'm sure...
And you were this cute little girl.
Right, exactly.
With a jar.
My tangled side ponytail, and I'm sure... they all kind of threw in a little money, and then I realized at the end of my little walk, wow, I have no idea what to do with this money. I don't know any poor people. I don't even know what that means to be poor, actually. And so I think that was sort of the beginning of a whole lifetime for me of kind of trying to think through, like, I have this jar of whether it's, you know, financial wealth, whether it's, you know, energy, whether it's skills. I was blessed to go to a really wonderful college where I learned all this analytical skill, like, what do I do with this in a way that actually makes a difference? And how do I close the gap so I do know poor people? I mean, I think that there was a profound sadness in the fact that this little girl that I was had no idea what that even meant, because there's such social stratification in our society. And so I'm always kind of looking at how do I humanize people in every circumstance? How do I know my neighbors? How do I, you know, sort of personalize this idea of living an ethical life in whatever way I can?
And without it being totally goofball. I mean, you profile somebody named Emily Abt, who kind of tried to make it in another, tried to be in hip-hop culture.
Right.
And she just totally didn't fit, and they looked at her and were, what are you doing here?
Right, exactly. And I think that, you know, that sort of jar metaphor, that sense of having this unearned privilege, I think when you don't use it and you don't figure out how to be honest about it with people, there is kind of a temptation to sort of morph into whatever the culture is that you're attracted to, in which, you know, Emily's case, that was hip-hop music. And there's sort of this level of, like, an attraction to suffering that I talk about in her profile that I think is very common in my generation. There's so many privileged kids kind of feeling like, if I can only sort of masquerade in this other culture, then I don't have to deal with all this frickin' privilege that I don't know what to do with.
We're talking to Courtney Martin. Talk about, you mentioned this at the beginning of the book, the importance of Barack Obama's candidacy on your generation.
Well, I think it was really interesting because I started the book before, I started thinking about the book far before Barack Obama was on the scene. I mean, I did see him give his 2004 DNC speech, and I was so struck. I was like, this is my moment. This is what my parents talk about when they talk about Kennedy or talk about these moments where they were truly inspired, because I'd never experienced that previously.
Yeah. I know a number of people. I didn't see that speech, but I know people who saw that. A good friend of mine saw that speech, and she said, I want that man to be president of the United States in 04.
I actually that day, the next day, I think, made a bunch of T-shirts with friends that we were, you know, trying to put Kerry stuff on them. And I ended up making an Obama T-shirt, you know, which at the time felt like this sort of crazy thing. But, you know, come to find out in 2008, it would be a reality. So, I mean, I think for a lot of us, he represents both. Mostly in sort of an identity, sort of cultural context, less in a political context, especially the more he's in office and proves to be human just like everybody else. I think it was the first moment a lot of us had of really having a personal connection to a politician, really feeling like we could be heard and seen and reflected in the government at the highest level in our country. And, you know, of course, there's been a lot of disappointment since we all have come to realize that Obama is part of a very broken system, and the issue is not necessarily just one person in office, but the fact that our whole kind of legislative branch is broken and our electoral policy is totally screwed up. And so there's just a lot of disillusionment, I think, now. But I think initially, young people were just so excited to actually connect with and feel mirrored by a presidential candidate.
So there is one person who is, I think, probably better known than all the others in the book, named Rosario Dawson. She's an actor who's about probably 29 or 30 years old right now, who's been in many, many movies. And the way you write about her is basically she's got all the power, money, visibility, beauty, you know, celebrity, anything that anybody could ever want. She's got it. So the question is, what's she doing with it?
Right. And for her, the question is, how do I actually authentically get involved in issues? Because there's so much pressure from so many different places for me to, you know, offer my power and my privilege. And how do I do that authentically? Rosario is fascinating because she grew up actually in a squat in the Lower East Side. She had no running water for a while, and her parents are these like hardcore activists, poor people. I mean, she grew up very poor, and she was discovered on her stoop when she was 15 years old by a filmmaker named Harmony Korine, and
just happened to be walking by and said,
let's
talk to this pretty long-legged girl, see if she wants to be on TV.
Yeah, the funny thing is she at that time felt incredibly awkward, like most, you know, incredibly beautiful women who have that story of like, oh, I was the most awkward teenager in the world. That's also how Rosario feels. But apparently these guys saw something in her and ended up putting her in a movie called Kids, which was really her launch as an actor. And so she's had this wild trajectory of coming from absolute poverty, really happy. I mean, she had this incredibly happy childhood. She talks about it with absolute admiration for her parents and just really grew up around artists and feels great about it. But economically, she's had this crazy shift from that place to now being, you know, one of the best paid actors in Hollywood. And so she's in all of these movies. She did, you know, 6 Pounds with Will Smith. You know, she's like traveled all these places and had access to all this money and sort of media power that her parents never would have dreamed of. So she's excited to use that and figure out how to use it authentically. At the same time, she's actually sort of envious of her mother, who can walk into, you know, Women's Inc., which is one of the first organizations she was ever exposed to, and just really, you know, pull up her shirt sleeves and get down to work, and no one questions whether she really cares about the issue. Whereas Rosario feels like everyone wants something from her and no one quite believes her in her authenticity. So it's a really interesting place to be.
How would you like your work and this book to inspire people who are in their 20s and younger?
Well, you know, as I say in the book, I really just hope it's an invitation. I hope it's a way to kind of look at, okay, let me try on. There are all these different ways of trying to make a meaningful life. There's all these different ways of trying to, you know, offer my gifts to the world. And what fits, what feels right? I feel like there's just such a lack of real-world stories of activism that it makes it really difficult when you are young and you do want to give back to actually figure out a way to do that, because you haven't seen it and there aren't enough stories about it. You feel like, okay, if I, like, cure cancer by 15, then maybe I can get on the Today Show, or, you know, I'll just give up and go work on Wall Street. Like, there just aren't enough models to try on. So I hope this is a book that gives young people a variety of models to try on, and I hope it just inspires people to think more about you know, kind of abandoning some of that save the world rhetoric and really getting nitty gritty about kind of what gifts do I have to offer and how can I offer them right now, even if it's not the perfect form.
Well, and the world is an awfully big place.
Yes. Yes.
I mean, working on maybe one little tiny corner of it would be a good place to start.
Absolutely. I think the sad thing, I mean, there's so many wonderful things about being raised at a time when we were told that we were wonderful and special and had all these gifts, that, you know, so many wonderful things about that. The sad thing about that is I think it sets some of us up to expect like fireworks or awards or some sort of big recognition. And right. A lot of this work is like daily grind, tough stuff where you have to learn to emotionally be buoyed by each little thing that you do, even if it's as small as in Raoul's case, you know, getting one kid to feel okay about being out in the real world and having a job.
Courtney Martin is author of the new book, Do It Anyway, The New Generation of Activists, and she will be at Garcia Street Books this afternoon at 5 o'clock. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, jazz.